But even before Lenny and Kevin discovered the login-out patch, they had used Kevin's wiles to get access to the company's VMS development cluster. Digital's largest software development facility is a complex of buildings in Nashua, New Hampshire. Three of the Nashua buildings are at 110 Spitbrook Road and are codenamed ZKO1, ZKO2, and ZKO3. The ZKO complex is the software capital of the company. It employs about 2,000 people, more than half of them programmers, and has more than 3,000 computers on site, 30 of them mainframes. There is a heliport outside that employees can use to travel to other major digital facilities or to Boston's Logan Airport. ZKO is set in the middle of a stand of hardwoods near a pond. It's at least a quarter of a mile to walk indoors all the way from one end of the complex to the other, and as you walk down the hall, you look out at a landscape that probably hasn't changed much since the days of the American Revolution. It's an intriguing mixture of moods, and the floor-to-ceiling windows along the hallways manage to blur the boundary between modern high-tech and hardwood forest. Managing 3,000 of anything can be tricky. People who manage large collections of computers typically organize them into groups, and into groups of groups. Fred Brooks, the chief designer of IBM's OS 360 operating system, made a shrewd observation some time ago. The structure of a computer system almost always mirrors the structure of the human organization that created it. As a result, the VMS computers in digital are largely organized into groups that correspond to the management structure. People who work together cluster their computers together under a single administration. However, technical peers work across the grain of the organization and often give one another privileges on their own machines. The star development cluster of VAXes in the ZKO complex was where all of Digital's VMS development work took place. Late one night, soon after Lenny started at VPA, Kevin stationed Lenny at VPA and, from a payphone, called a graveyard shift operator in the star control room. Posing as a technician in the field, Kevin had her walk over to the console and type in a single command that seemed harmless enough to someone without an intimate knowledge of VMS. Without hesitation, she logged into the computer, thereby spawning a new process. A $ prompt appeared on Lenny's screen, the signal that he could now type in privileged commands reserved for a digital operator. But the full import of where Kevin and Lenny had landed eluded them at first. Kevin wasn't so interested in hanging around to check out the development cluster. It looked a lot like any other VAX system. Instead, once they were in, Kevin invoked his personal battle cry. Get privd, set up, move on. Setting up was a matter of creating an account for themselves so that they could get in at some future time. Who knows, the reasoning went, when access to the company's development computers might be useful. Only gradually did it dawn on Kevin that they had achieved their ultimate goal. Breaking into the development clusters could give them unlimited access to the VMS source code. But even though they were inside the temple, there were still obstacles. They needed to transport the software to some safer haven, some secret location. In order to acquire the source code in such volume, one of the things the two data hijackers needed was a high-speed gateway through which they could transfer the programs. Relying on their relatively low-speed modems at VPA would have been like siphoning the ocean through a straw. Just as important, they needed to find a link from EasyNet to the outside world. Digital's computer network was not, as a rule, connected to the outside world, but there were some exceptions. Digital's Western Research Lab in Palo Alto, it turned out, had just the gateway they were looking for. Established in 1982 by a group of defectors from Xerox's Palo Alto Research Center, DeckWorld, as it was called, represented Digital's future, a computer science laboratory where researchers experimented with the most advanced ideas in computing. The Palo Alto lab was composed of about 25 people in a four-story streamlined brick building that also served as Digital's Western headquarters in the downtown section of Palo Alto, an upper-middle-class community next door to Stanford University. The Western Research Lab seemed more like a Silicon Valley startup than a corporate outpost. The lab was also one of the few Unix havens in Digital's otherwise VMS-dominated universe. It was logical that the researchers at Deckworld would want to work with Unix, specifically Digital's version called Ultrix. Not only had they grown up with Unix, but in their frequent cooperative research with university scientists, Unix was the common denominator. And there are other things that make Unix attractive. It is highly portable, which means it can run on almost any type of computer, from an IBM PC to a Cray supercomputer. VMS, on the other hand, is confined to VAX computers. Unix, which was invented by two computer researchers at AT&T's Bell Laboratories, has gradually become a standard for scientists, engineers, and universities. Scientists at the Western Research Lab were experts in the Unix operating system, though they held a grudging respect for VMS. Also at Palo Alto was the Digital Workstation Systems Engineering Group, a small group of designers inside Digital who were working around the clock on the next generation workstation, Digital's first machine ever to be designed solely for the Unix operating system. It was being built outside Digital's traditional development process, and the company wanted to get the machine out as soon as possible in order to remain competitive with smaller, younger companies such as Sun Microsystems. The new workstation's code name was PMAX. High-speed network gateways may have been common at large universities and research laboratories, but they were found less frequently at large corporations. Most IBM sites have no direct connections to the outside world, mainly for reasons of corporate concern about security, and those with connections can only dial out to other computers. They cannot accept incoming calls. The digital gateway in Palo Alto, with links throughout the world, was extraordinary in its very existence. It could crank data in and out at 56,000 bits per second, which is the equivalent of transmitting all of Moby Dick in less than 2 minutes. Its purpose was to put the research of Digital's computer scientists closer to research that was going on at places like Stanford and Berkeley. Having good network connections mattered to a computer scientist in 1988 the way a properly equipped kitchen would matter to Julia Child. As part of the international research community, sharing ideas and papers and ongoing research with counterparts around the world, the Palo Alto computer scientists believed it was necessary to have direct connections to the global Internet. And in recognition of the open-mindedness back at corporate headquarters, the computer scientists in Palo Alto took great care to operate their precious gateway responsibly. To give the best possible oversight for both maintenance and security, PhDs in computer science took turns poring over daily log files, a job usually performed by administrative staff. So it was only a matter of hours after the intrusions into Palo Alto computers began that the gateway watchers there noticed something amiss. The Palo Alto scientists who monitored the gateway, Brian Reed and Paul Vixie, decided they were dealing with experts. Sometimes the intruders came into Digital over a phone line, as an employee might dial into the company's computers from home. From there, they knew how to get access to EasyNet. From EasyNet, they could connect to any of the small VMS computers in the Palo Alto building, often a desktop workstation where they experimented with passwords until they managed to log on. Once they had logged on, they exploited weaknesses in VMS to gain privileges on the small system. Once they had done that, they would commandeer the small computer, forcing it to masquerade as a larger system on the network, some users of which would have expanded access rights. This is a method known as network spoofing. At the same time, the intruders would plant their Trojan horse, a modification of the login-out program, and capture user passwords, and then take advantage of the natural tendency for people to use the same password on all the systems on which they worked, whether VMS or Unix.